This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, it's great to have your company this Friday afternoon. I'm Cassie Huff with you for The Country Hour, and today I'll be delving into the emerging technology in agriculture known as nanopesticides. Obviously, nano means very small, so it's quite a revolutionary technology. The CSIRO has joined forces with world leaders in this technology to work out how regulators like the APVMA will actually evaluate the technology.
We have basically helped sort of identify the questions and laid down the steps the regulators and industry would together go through, and how would they be able to answer with the available scientific methods.
It's some interesting new technology. I'll get into that in the next half hour or so. I'll also have the latest on the Canadian drought and the effect that that is still having on Australian grain prices. But first to wool, and Australian Wool Innovation, the not-for-profit company that's funded by Wool Grower Levies and is responsible for research and development, is preparing to commercialise part of its highly criticised online market platform, WoolQ. Wool growers and broker groups have welcomed the move, saying the project, which has cost more than $6 million, has been a waste of industry funds. But there are concerns that AWI might not be able to recoup its investment. Luke Wong reports.
WoolQ is a secure online platform where wool growers, classes, brokers and buyers can access digital tools to support all stages of the wool growing and selling cycle.
Australian Wool Innovation, or AWI, has spent $6.3 million and more than 5 years developing WoolQ, its online selling and traceability platform.
When you're ready to sell your wool, the WoolQ market will offer two distinct options for trading.
All of the development of WoolQ, the market component of WoolQ, has basically been completed, and I think we're in a position now where we'll look at commercialising that.
Jock Laurie is the chair of the not-for-profit marketing research and development company, which is funded by Wool Grower Levies. He says it's time to move WoolQ to the next phase.
AWI have had a few sales on it, sort of testing it, but in the end it'll be whether growers actually want to use it, whether brokers want to use it, and whether buyers want to use it. That'll be the big turning point. And over the next 6 months, I would imagine the company will sort of put that into the commercial phase, because it's not AWI's role to be running commercial enterprises.
Rowan Woods is the president of the National Council of Wool Selling Brokers. He's been pushing AWI to commercialise the market component of WoolQ. Now he wants to see action.
Well, Luke, brokers in general would welcome that announcement. That's been our recommendation to AWI, and if they deliver on that announcement, we would see that as a positive move and a clear indication that they're now prepared to take our recommendation seriously. Brokers have not generally been supportive of the selling platform component of WoolQ. Several brokers have tried it, and none that I'm aware of have been satisfied with it.
He says there have been several issues with the project's development.
Firstly, the cost. So you've got to remember that it's levy payers that are paying for this development, and they would want to see a return on that investment, and that return on investment has not materialised to any degree. Well over $6 million spent on something that has barely sold a bale of wool. So that's the primary concern, and the other concerns are that it simply was something that wasn't required. There's already sufficient mechanisms in place for the exchange of wool. For those growers who want to list wool for sale at their price, they can already do that with these systems. And, you know, to conduct a sale, you need the other side, and buyers have been equally unsupportive of WoolQ. Buyer issues usually revolve around the pace of a sale and the time it takes to buy lots. And these systems succeed or fail on volume and throughput, and even existing systems are struggling with that. There's not enough wool available to have two separate markets.
But the Gemalong-based wool broker wants AWI to retain parts of the platform, which he says still hold value.
So there is the traceability aspects of WoolQ that that should be further enhanced. The one area where WoolQ has an opportunity to salvage some of that investment is in that traceability area. AWI really are in the box seat to be heavily involved with the development of and possibly provide an Australian industry traceability and quality assurance program designed here and relevant for here, relevant to our growers.
Australian Wool Growers Association Director Rob Ingram agrees that the market component of WoolQ should be sold off.
Are we going to go anywhere near recouping the amount of money that we've invested to date as wool growers in the technology?
Speaking from his farm at Delegate in the New South Wales Snowy Mountains, Rob Ingram says he was surprised by the news, but is concerned there may be little interest in any sale.
Our networks are saying to us, we don't think that there is a substantial commercial value in the platform. But that being the case, that's what you have to accept when you do something like this, and you've misread the market.
What are your fears now that if they put it out to market and maybe nobody bites?
Well, I've had this discussion this morning, actually, with a number of people, and I've said, well, if nobody bites, we as the shareholders have to suffer that loss. And given that the market shows no interest in it, we have to close funding of it down completely, except for the traceability blockchain component of it, if we're not, again, replicating the private sector.
An independent report published in August recommended AWI to perform an internal review of WoolQ. The report noted that a goal of 2% of all Australian wool traded on the site had not been met. The company has since reported there are more than 3,400 registered users, 1,800 of which are wool growers. In its operating plan released in June, AWI was set to invest a further $600,000 into the platform and set a target to increase the number of wool grower users by 250 this financial year. The federal government contributes funding to AWI's research and development activities, capped at 0.5% of the wool industry's gross domestic product. The company faced fierce scrutiny during a Senate estimates hearing in March.
So when you say made some assessment, did Jack, Bill and Pete reckon we could get about 2%, or did we have some data?
Senator Bridget McKenzie questioned Chief Operations Officer John Roberts about the $6.3 million already spent on the project.
What is the return on investment from WoolQ to date in dollar terms?
We haven't derived a revenue stream from the platform at this point, because we are yet to start charging for the WoolQ market service, because we haven't had the volumes to make that.
Because people don't see it as valuable.
Our experience is that people do see it as valuable.
Yeah.
And we've had very positive feedback with the brokers and the exporters and the growers we've worked with.
I just think it's incredible that you can throw so much money at something that isn't actually delivering for you, but I'll be asking.
Sellers using WoolQ are now charged a $5 fee for every bale sold through the site. WoolPoll, the triennial vote where wool growers decide the levy rate paid to fund Australian wool innovation, is currently underway.
Luke Wong reporting there. This weekend, Landline will actually explore this year's WoolPoll levy vote and the challenges that wool growers and AWI are facing. So that's on at 12:30 on Sunday on ABC TV. Now, the Bureau of Meteorology says La Niña is now an even chance of return for a second consecutive spring. It's a weather phenomenon that largely affects the eastern states, but it usually means rain, and hopefully it comes off, because the rain can't come soon enough for South Australia. I'll have the weather forecasts soon, but one thing's for sure, canola prices are still holding up, and that's largely because Canada's again revised its canola crop down to 12.8 million tonnes. Now, Canada usually grows about 90 million tonnes of canola and exports about half of that. James Fulsham is a West Australian grain trader with Australian Asian Agricultural Exports, known as AAAX, and he says this week's announcement of a reduced Canadian crop comes as no surprise, but what it does do is confirm to the market that there will be a shortage of oil seeds for some time, and he also reckons there will be an increased demand for Australian oats and high-protein breads as well.
The trade is following the situation in Canada very closely, and I think there'd been a bit of an expectation amongst the trade for some time that the numbers were going to come down, so it sort of, you know, confirmed what people were expecting. I think, the situation in Canada is very bad, and it's worse that we've seen there for a number of years. So, I mean, obviously the market has already reacted to it, so it hasn't sort of surprised the market or anything like that, but it's more confirmed what people were thinking. You know, it basically confirms to people that the trade is justified in paying what they're paying at the moment, and it sort of makes these levels more sort of sustainable. I mean, if you'd seen something, revised the other way, for example, when the trade were expecting it to come down, you probably would have seen a pretty significant sell-off.
Canada usually uses about 9 to 10 million tonnes domestically each year, so it doesn't really leave much for export markets, which they've been traditionally very strong in supplying. Are we now seeing markets open up for Australian canola that haven't previously been there before?
Into Europe, for example, I mean, I think they'll just take more Australian predominantly. The sort of trade flow in canola is pretty fixed and known. Like, there's obviously a lot of it goes to the EU. Where they were buying Canadian before, they'll substitute it for more Australian. I think that's probably what you'll see. You might see a few new markets pop up here and there. Markets like sort of Pakistan and Nepal, that'll take a bit of Canadian. They'll probably take more Australian. So I think that's probably the sort of theme that you'll see. Market share of Aussie canola go up in certain markets rather than a bunch of new markets popping up.
Is there a long-term benefit there in terms of Australia getting a foothold and a reputation into some of these markets that it didn't previously have an opportunity to get into?
You know, if you haven't sold to a market for a few years because you haven't worked on price, I mean, there's certain markets where, you know, Canada has a freight advantage where all of a sudden Australia might work in there. It might have worked at some point in the past, but it's working. Just gives the Australian trade the opportunity to kind of refresh a lot of the relationships. They may, obviously the quality between origins is often different, so they might get used to using Australian again and make them a bit more sort of sticky in the future. So a lot of buyers around the world are sort of pretty price sensitive. So, you know, a lot of it ultimately comes down to price. But I think it is an unfortunate story for Canada, but it is, you know, a fortunate story for Australia, especially considering the size of the canola crop this year.
We're obviously looking at decile 10 prices at the moment. How long do you think we'll keep seeing these? Will this flow through into next year and beyond?
I mean, you're already seeing elevated prices for next year's crop. I mean, I think Canadian crop is so small that it'll take a while for them to kind of build stocks up and kind of rebuild, I guess. So even if you have a big crop next year, Australia will still be in a probably stronger position than they normally are. So it's going to have a meaningful, I mean, obviously at least until the new crop comes online. But even when the new crop comes online, I think we'll be better positioned because they're going to be starting from such a low base.
You're also dealing in other grains as well, James. Are you seeing similar effects? Canada grows wheat. Are we seeing a kick in demand for Australian wheat based off that Canadian drought as well?
The more we kind of compete directly with Canada, the more of a direct impact you're seeing on price. It's certainly having an effect on wheat and other commodities as well. Obviously, you know, something like wheat, global production is a lot bigger. So if Canada's can't export well, you know, you can go to the Black Sea or you can go to South America and Argentina or something like that. There's more production generally. You know, other commodities as well, like, for example, oats. A lot of the oats come out of Canada. Again, similar to canola, Australia is probably the next most obvious place to get them if you can't get them out of Canada. So oats will be an interesting one because, you know, the situation with containers is so difficult at the moment. It's difficult to get the kind of export capacity in containers. A lot of oats normally go out in containers. So, you know, at the moment, we're probably not quite there on the other commodities to the same degree that we are on canola. But as the season sort of plays out, you might see start to influence price a bit more.
James Fulsham, AAAX, speaking with Joe Prendergast. And speaking of grains, there's still hope for a large crop in South Australia, winter crop in South Australia, even with this unforecast dry weather that the state has experienced. But workers will have to be flexible to get the job off, according to Viterra. Operations manager Michael Hill says the company is confident of an efficient harvest, but recruitment has been harder due to COVID border closures. He says they have been busy preparing sites, including removing some old cell blocks, as harvest is just around the corner.
Obviously, we've had a big outturn program. We've shipped about 5.5 million tonnes. The remaining shipping is in the Adelaide ports, so Port Lincoln, Thevenard, Port Giles, Wallaroo are pretty much all completely done. So now it's just a matter of cleaning up the sites, and we've got a very low carry coming into this harvest, and so we've got 10 million tonnes of storage. So we've got the capacity to handle what's going to be delivered this year.
Has there been many upgrades needed at our sites across the state?
Our upgrades generally happen every year. We spend about $40 million on capex and maintenance, and we have an ongoing program to upgrade elevator belts, upgrade drive over hoppers. So that happens every year, yes.
We've seen one of the silo cells come down at Woodner. What was that one and why was that needed to be done?
What happened at Woodner, and they're actually demolishing one at Lock as well afterwards, But obviously both sites are really important to our site network. But looking at the concrete silo blocks at those sites, they've been removed for safety reasons. So they haven't been open for a couple of years now. So it's better to, with the concrete works, to demolish them and make it a safe environment for obviously our employees, our growers and our contractors and visitors to the site.
How old were these cells?
Woodnum was built in 1960 and Lock was built in 1964 and then had another extension a few years later. So they're quite old.
Are there any others across the state that will need this to happen as well?
The only other ones we're currently doing is Narracourt down the southeast, and that's a steel bin down there. That's been closed for 10 years, so we're taking that block down. And at Two Wells, where we used to have a packing plant, and that's been closed for a couple of years, we're taking some of the equipment down, like some elevators and bins, where we had a company do a structural review for us. So it's an old place, and it was quite unsafe, so we blocked all that out. That was all under exclusion zones. So that's all coming down in the next month or two as well.
These probably don't need to be replaced, do they? If they haven't been used for this many years, it's just they're getting rid of them and leaving the site clear?
That's correct, Brooke.
As you mentioned before, Michael, this is going to be one of the biggest harvests for a few years. Since rail stopped on the EP as well, is Viterra confident it'll be able to truck out that extra grain without too many issues?
Yeah, we've had logistics department have been having discussions with the carriers on Eyre Peninsula, and they do put in a really stringent plan about overflowing during harvest for shipping and for the program coming out of harvest. So they're pretty confident that it'll all be fine, yes.
In terms of workforce, obviously Viterra put the call out for workers for this harvest. How is that going and are you getting enough workers' interest for this, and has it been hard with borders shut as well?
It has been challenging, the recruitment, yes. With the borders closed, has made it more difficult, and obviously at the moment getting people from New South Wales is extremely difficult. But we've got over about 2,300 applications at the moment, which we're working through. We've engaged a labour hire company. We're organising accommodation at some of the sites as well, because that's been quite important to applications. So the other issues we look at is, do we shift people from the southeast, where it's quite a late harvest, across to the west coast to help out, and then vice versa when that slows down?
I guess it's going to have to be a pretty flexible harvest then.
Yes, correct. Correct. It's a little bit like last year. Obviously, we had COVID last year as well. So quite similar, but just a little more difficult when you don't have all the backpackers from overseas. You know, we're pretty confident that we've got things in place for the growers. So if you look at the recruitment right across the ag industry, it's going to be really important. The value of grain this year is high. So we're going to push at two shifts for all our major sites, because we want to get this crop off as quick as possible for the grower, so they can get the most value as well.
Viterra Operations Manager Michael Hill speaking to Brooke Neindorf. It's 23 minutes past 12. Before I get to weather, Eyre Peninsula Cooperative Bulk Handling has taken another step towards building a port at Cape Hardy with the purchase of 400 acres of land at the site. The cooperative is looking to build a multi-user port precinct and a deep water port. EPCBH CEO Tim Schultz says the purchase of the land will allow them to pursue a range of opportunities to value add the site.
The land adjoins Iron Road land, it's got road frontage, and it provides a good, strong strategic base for the cooperative moving forward with the Cape Hardy development. It was something the board thought about and wanted to move down that direction for quite a while, and that's to make sure that the farmers as such maintain their own place in whatever happens at Cape Hardy. But also there are a number of opportunities that we've been made aware of that really make sense if farmers actually own a chunk of the asset rather than relying on everybody else.
Was this purchased from a local farmer?
Yes, it was, yeah.
What does this now mean for the plan going ahead?
The plan going ahead, we're still working very closely with our joint development partners. It is complicated and complex to build any sort of major infrastructure, let alone a greenfield port. So that goes ahead, but it does give us as a farming industry and as farmers more options in relation to storage and handling and value adding and things like grain services. So it actually expands our option as a cooperative, and we'd like to think it makes us more interesting as a partner.
Is this the only land that you look at purchasing, or is there a potential down the track for more adjoining land?
No, it's a significant. It's 400, well, it's 160 hectares. It is in a really good strategic location, and we think this, for the foreseeable future, this covers off on any sort of opportunity that we have identified at this stage.
Can you crop it?
It's currently all cropping. It's currently being cropped. That process will continue with the local farmers.
You touched there that you know, everything's sort of still rolling ahead with your plans, but you know, looking at valuating to the site, what's happening with that?
Look, we've got some further announcements hopefully coming out next week that will probably open up that point. But the port has been talked about in terms of green energy, and we have been working in that space, and we hope to make some more announcements about that. And that particularly applies in agriculture to carbon, low carbon or carbon free fertiliser. So that's one area that we've identified as having a lot of potential.
EPCBH CEO Tim Schultz speaking with Brooke Nindorf. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology where I'm joined by Vince Rollins. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So I understand it's going to be a bit thundery and gusty around South Australia this afternoon.
Yeah, over parts of South Australia. So we did see quite a bit of thunderstorm activity over the northwest pastoral district yesterday, a little bit over the west coast region as well. But overnight, it sort of developed over some of the central districts, moved through Adelaide, and then this morning went through parts of the eastern districts around the Riverland, Murrayland. So still got a little bit of activity in that cloud band over the north and east, and we are expecting some more thunderstorm activity through that region as we go through the afternoon into the evening. And we'll see it just slowly contracting to the northeast. So by tomorrow morning, we're just looking at some remnant thunderstorm activity just up in the far northeast of the state, and that's expected to clear out by the afternoon. So, yeah, we've got quite a bit of wind ahead of that trough that is moving across the state at the moment. So those northerly winds in the east are expected to produce a bit of raised dust, and there's a bit of wind aloft as well. So if we do see some thunderstorm activity, it is expected to be quite gusty, and there's still a slight risk of some severe gusts associated with those thunderstorms near the New South Wales border in particular. So we'll be watching that one pretty closely if we get some organised thunderstorms. But elsewhere across the state, we are expecting some showers to sort of extend over the southern, mainly the southern agricultural area. But yeah, behind that trough, we are seeing cooler south to southwesterly winds. So still pretty warm to hot in the eastern north, but yeah, those cooler winds certainly coming behind it. Now, as we head into tomorrow, as I mentioned, we've still got a bit of activity up in the northeast during the morning, but we're still expecting shower activity over the southern agricultural area in a west to southwesterly airstream. Start to see a high pressure system moving across from the west. So as we head into Sunday morning, we've got a couple of things happening. Got the high the ridge of high pressure over the north, and we've got another frontal feature moving across the south. So we will see quite a bit of shower activity over the southern agricultural area. But during that morning period, with the clear skies, light winds due to that ridge, we are expecting pretty cold temperatures and some areas of frost over inland parts. Now, as we head into Monday, some pretty cold air coming up behind that front. So we'll see the showers push a bit further north into the south of the pastoral districts, but increasing over the southern agricultural area. And we're expecting to see some small hail and thunderstorm activity over the southeast of the state as well. Now, that all starts to contract southwards and ease during Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But again, under the influence of that high-pressure system, which is moving to the east, we'll see some some clear skies and light winds inland, so some more cold mornings expected during Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and some areas of frost. But we will see the winds during the daytime, particularly during Wednesday, Thursday, starting to swing back around to the north, temperatures warming up, and that's all ahead of another system that is expected to move across the state during Friday. Now, not a great deal of rainfall associated with these systems moving through. We're generally looking at less than a couple of millimetres, maybe getting up to 2 to 5 over the southern agricultural area, with a few locations getting a bit more, and around that sort of maybe 2 to 10 millimetres up in the far northeast of the state, Cassie.
Thanks so much for that, Vince. That was Vince Rollins from the Bureau of Meteorology in the far west of New South Wales. It's going to be partly cloudy, some medium chance of showers in the morning and afternoon. It'll get down to 13 to 17 degrees, but the temperatures will reach the low to mid-20s.
The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff.
Hi, happy Friday. I'm so glad you could join me this afternoon. Now, you've probably heard the global red meat industry has been singled out in climate change reports for the role it plays in global warming, but the meat industry is claiming that's actually a big part of the solution as well. So I'm going to take a look at some of the claims next, and you're going to meet Jazz the Wonder Dog, who is helping with on-farm conservation works.
So we'd like to keep a record of how many echidnas there are. So I can find an echidna digging on the property and set Jazz out to find the animal so that I can actually sight the live animal rather than just the digging. So she's good at that. She's got a really big thing about stumpy tail lizards. She likes to find those and tell us when they're around. But, you know, they're very common here. So that's just her thing, I think.
And she works for Pat's, not even food. What a dog. You'll meet Jazz soon, but now we have to find out what's making news with Wendy Glamachat. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, Australia's first nuclear-powered submarines are unlikely to enter the water until the end of the next decade. The federal government will spend the next 12 to 18 months working out plans to build at least 8 nuclear subs under a new partnership with the US and UK. Meanwhile, Adelaide's naval shipbuilder ASC says it will offer jobs to naval group workers who need employment, but it won't be able to instantly take on the 350 people who've been left in limbo by yesterday's submarines announcement. The New South Wales and federal governments have announced plans to trial home quarantine in Sydney. The pilot, to be operated and monitored by New South Wales Health and New South Wales Police, will trial a 7-day home quarantine program for around 175 people. New South Wales has recorded 1,284 new local cases of coronavirus and another 12 deaths. And an Adelaide paedophile who admitted to filming and publishing himself sexually abusing children in Cambodia will be eligible for parole in 3 years after being sentenced in Adelaide's district court today. 48-year-old Jeffrey Moyle pleaded guilty to 11 offences between 2002 and 2005. He was today sentenced to spend at least 4 years and 6 months in prison for his crimes. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, there's a new campaign out with the meat industry claiming it can significantly reduce methane emissions from cows and be part of the solution to climate change, not the cause. Now, that could be a good line for the industry and the federal government to run ahead of the Glasgow Climate Summit, but a leading greenhouse researcher says a net reduction in methane would not be enough to bring the methane down and just limit the damage. The industry, the red meat industry, is being forced to deal with emissions as trading nations and multinational corporations demand stronger action on climate change. So David Claughton took a look at some of these claims.
The beef industry wants you to feel good about eating meat. There's a growing trend towards consumption of plant-based products by people concerned about the environment, and governments in Europe and the US are beginning to impose tariffs on emissions-intensive industries, including agriculture. This campaign by industry body Meat and Livestock Australia includes a short animation that differentiates cattle from coal. It argues that methane from cattle is just part of the natural cycle and not nearly as bad as carbon dioxide from coal.
Because of this cycling of carbon, if cattle numbers stay the same, eventually the methane produced by cattle will not contribute additional global warming. However, CO2 produced from burning fossil fuels is CO2 that is new to the atmosphere. It does not stem from this natural carbon cycle. It builds on what's already there, day after day, year after year. What's really exciting is, if we reduce methane emissions from cows using innovative technologies and grazing practices, such as improving their diet, the red meat and livestock industry can be part of the climate solution.
Roger that.
It sounds very positive, and right at the end they show a big thermometer with the planet's temperature falling. The message is that the cattle industry can actually play a part in reducing the temperature of the planet. I went to Jason Strong from Meat and Livestock Australia to confirm that is actually the industry's position.
Absolutely, the livestock sector can have a positive impact on reducing the impact on the environment.
So not just being carbon zero, but actually cooling the planet.
The methane produced by cattle only has a 10-year cycle. So if we reduce the amount of methane produced by the animals and then we find ways to capture the methane that is produced, absolutely contributing to cooling the planet.
MLA point to research in the US on emissions, which states that by continuously improving production efficiency and management practices, animal agriculture can be a short-term solution to fight climate warming, which the global community can leverage while developing long-term solutions for fossil fuel carbon emissions. Work is also being done in Australia and the Netherlands using seaweed and other food additives to reduce emissions from cattle by as much as 90%. So is it true that cattle could help cool the planet by reducing the amount of methane in the atmosphere? Professor Richard Eckard from the Melbourne University leads their research centre focused on greenhouse gases. He can see an opportunity for the cattle industry to play a critical role in addressing global warming in the next decade.
If you think of the latest IPCC report, it's saying it's going to be very difficult to actually achieve the 1.5 degrees. If we make a real material change to carbon dioxide today, say we stop emitting one molecule of CO2, it takes almost 100 years before that changes the climate. Methane is a short-lived gas, and so within a 12-year period, a change in methane today reduces temperature in 12 years' time. So you can see from a policy point of view why that would be quite important. It's kind of a get-out-of-jail card to focus on short-lived gases. Because we have this imperative. On the flip side, there is really good science that would say methane doesn't have to be zero. Because it's a short-lived gas, it doesn't have to actually achieve zero emissions like CO2 does to have the same reduction in its impact on the environment. So you'll see that reflected in the New Zealand carbon neutral bill, for example, where they've set a target of net zero emissions for long-lived gases like nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide by 2050. But they haven't set a zero target. They basically said methane just needs to fall somewhere between 20 and 40% by 2050 to have the equivalent. So if you're looking at reducing global warming quickly, methane is a good target. If you're looking at equity between various players that are emitting, power stations have to get to zero by 2050, but livestock don't, in order to have the same contribution to reducing warming.
But the question is, can the technology, like the things that they're talking about here, the additives to the food, etc., the different management techniques, can that reduce significantly the amount of emissions, methane emissions from livestock?
Yeah, look, we've moved from the days when I started in this area about 15, 20 years ago where we could achieve 10 to 20% reduction in methane, and that was through adding supplements like more grain in the diet, grape mark, oils into the diet, whole cottonseed into the diet. That achieved the sort of 20% mark. We've taken a quantum leap with two new supplements or additives inhibitors on the market, the seaweed and 3-NOP from DSM Nutrition. Those two have put us into the sort of 70, 80% category. And it's given us real hope that, we can address this problem to a greater quantum than we ever thought we could.
But the point is, if they reduce emissions from cattle broadly by these new technologies and management practices, could that bring the temperature of the planet down?
Yeah, it It wouldn't bring the temperature down. It would stop contributing more to the heating. But let me be clear. If the technologies reduce methane from the national herd by more than about 12% per decade, then there will definitely be a net reduction in methane in the atmosphere, which means that the temperature would come down.
Could it be big enough to make a difference? I mean, this is always the point that Australian farmers come back with. You know, we're so small in the global scheme of things, doesn't matter what we do. But could the cattle industry with this new technology and its changes actually contribute to improving the situation when it comes to global warming?
Yeah, look, you know, you're right. You know, if we applied this and we reduced the methane from the whole national herd in Australia down, it probably wouldn't make more than, you know, a fraction of a percent of the global heating problem. I think there's more to it, though, that, you know, this is a global problem and a global address of solutions being addressed. So there's significant research going on in the European Union, in Canada, in the United States now, in Brazil, in New Zealand. And if we address this to the sort of global livestock industries, then it can make a material difference.
Professor Richard Eckard, it's not exactly a ringing endorsement of MLA's campaign, but it could help to shift the conversation around beef and its environmental credentials at a critical time. The EU and the US are both moving towards carbon levies on emissions-intensive industries, and the next global summit on climate change is coming up later this year. Multinational corporations involved in the food chain are also setting up their own standards around sustainability and emissions that suppliers need to meet. With all that pressure, there's a lot riding on the technology to reduce emissions in cattle and on campaigns like this one to change the public's perception about beef. Maybe it could help save the planet.
That report by David Claughton, does that give you some food for thought? Maybe change your thoughts on the meat industry? I'd be interested to know what you make of the information there on how much difference changes to the cow's diet and reducing methane could have as part of the solution to climate change. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Staying somewhat in this area, but in the environmental area, but in chemicals. And new research has found that the emerging agrichemical technology known as nanopesticides could be one step closer to regulatory approval. Now, nanopesticides are tiny. They're about a 100th of the depth of a piece of paper, so absolutely tiny. And they have the potential to reduce the amount of chemicals that farmers use by improving the chemicals' efficiency and precision. But could that very attribute that makes nanotechnology appealing actually cause other issues? Now, evaluating the emerging technology is complex, and that's why the CSIRO has been involved in an international project to develop a framework to help regulators like the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority assess applications from chemical companies using this nanotechnology. And the CSIRO's Dr. Rai Kukuna explains just what nanotechnology is.
The nanotechnology, because of the size, just offers so many unique opportunities, particularly because of the very tiny size. Their properties change in a magical manner. You can do things simply because of the size, things which you otherwise couldn't do. So the surface area is the key property. Because of the smaller size, as you sort of divide a particle into smaller and smaller size, you increase the surface area, and that's where the property changes come in many different ways.
Can you tell me how this has led to some important advancements in both medicine and chemical, agrochemical use?
It sort of comes down to the targeted delivery, getting straight to the problem. So conventional pesticides, one of the problem is that what you apply, Not all of that gets to the problem, gets to the pest, gets to the disease organism. So there's a lot of material which is applied gets lost. In fact, it's a very tiny fraction which gets to do the job which we want it to do. With the nanotechnology and with that better properties, you can actually now deliver it in a targeted manner. And the same principle applies in nanomedicine, where you can deliver the drug to the tissue, say a cancerous tissue. Similarly, in agriculture, from nanopesticides point of view, you can deliver it in a targeted manner. For example, nematodes are active at the root in below the soil surface. So you don't need to apply it in on the top of the soil. Well, like conventional pesticide would stay there, most of it, and a small tiny fraction will go to the problem. In this case, you can encapsulate in a nanomaterial, a nanoparticle, a polymer that will facilitate its delivery to the target side. So you need a very small amount. And in that process, you are also minimizing losses and therefore protecting the environment as well.
But scientists do have some issues with the technology as well. What are they?
Well, I guess everything comes with the risks and the rewards. So definitely the advantages, as I mentioned, you could control its release, you can deliver it in a targeted fashion, but then you wonder whether the very property which is enabling for a chemical to go to places which we can now control or deliver, could it be sort of reaching to the point, say, in the body, in a human health perspective, into human body, in tissues and organs, which otherwise wouldn't go conventional molecules, because here we have this nanocarrier, and just like drug is delivered to a specific point, in this case, would that actually cross the barrier, if you like, the membrane of the cell, and will get to places? So that's the key concern, and that's where we needed to be extra careful and making sure that the products coming in the market actually are safe.
And the CSIRO has been looking at this. You've just released a paper. What has your paper focused on?
Yeah, this particular paper, which just came 2 days ago in Nature Nanotechnology, which is the top journal in this area of nanotechnology, that is focused on human health risk assessment. So essentially answering the questions about the potential risk pathways. And the opportunity to work with the global group of people and collaborator from across Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand through this agency, the UN of Chemists, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, we call it IUPAC, working with them on this project over several years, first with ecological risk assessment or environmental risk assessment, now human health risk assessment, is really an exciting project because we had the opportunity to work with the best minds around the world.
So your research is largely about providing the framework for chemical producers to work out how they would approach the issues that regulators might have.
Exactly. So it's in some ways, it's sort of facilitating the adoption of this technology and products and bringing them in the market, and that have to go through the regulatory stage of assessment and approval and registration. And in that, we have basically helped sort of identify the questions and laid down the steps the regulators and industry would together go through and how would they be able to answer with the available scientific methods. And so it lays the path and it's like a decision tree, it's a framework rather than answering a specific question, because the question will depend on the scenario, what product, where it is used, which country, which crop, and environmental conditions. So the questions are specific because the risk is specific to a scenario. So it's just the process and pathways to show to both regulators and industry that if you kind of taken this stepwise approach, you would be able to assess its risk in a sound manner, and then you will be in a much better position to evaluate the product. I would think with the time, the regulators will take it up, and this process has been more than 10 years now, which was initially championed by the Australian Pesticide and Veterinary Medicine Authority, because they were foreseeing, they were actually proactively working on this, thinking ahead that once these types of products are in the market, once they come to their desk, how would they evaluate, what would they need? So that's where we worked with them and started the process and initially looked at the environmental side of the risk and now human health risk. So I'm pretty convinced that it'll be very useful to both regulators and industry, and it will pave the path of adoption of this technology.
CSIRO researcher Dr. Rai Kukana explaining how some new chemical technology can be evaluated. Sounds like very interesting work. I'm sure we'll hear more about nanopesticides in the future. It is 12 minutes to one.
This week on Landline, how much should wool growers be levied to fund the Australian Wool Innovation Organisation? Also, Australian farmers' growing love of chickpeas. And meet Max Bergman, a passionate camel farmer and scientist who is also legally blind.
I'm just normal. well, I've got a disability, yeah, but so what? You know, just suck it up and deal with it.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Rural properties have dogs. Some are just for company. Others help round up sheep and cattle. But have you ever heard of a conservation dog before? Fiona Murdoch has one on her property at Collignon in northwest Victoria, and she told Kelly Hollingworth about the special work a conservation dog does.
Jazz is a Hungarian Vishla, which is a bit of a multi-purpose dog, and we consider her a conservation dog because her jobs on the property are primarily to find rabbit warrens. So she'll smell them out and let us know when she's found one. And because we've got so few rabbits on the property, it's really important to get those warrens when there's just a single active hole. That's her main job, but she also works through these areas of grassland and tells us when the quail are around. So last year we had a little button quail nesting on our place, which is really special. Just shows that the grassland's in good condition. And the trick with using a dog as a conservation dog is they need to be so well trained that they don't flush and hunt and chase animals. So she's a pointing dog. So when she finds what she's looking for, she'll just freeze and point with her nose. And then you can go up and see what it is she's found.
Many people will have heard of dogs to help round up sheep. They'll also have heard of having pets for companionship. How many people have conservation dogs?
Conservation dogs is a really growing thing. There's a lot of different purposes. They use conservation dogs to track down weeds. They use them for finding turtle nests so that they can protect those turtle nests from predation by foxes. They use them to find fox scats so they can collect the scats and find out what the foxes are eating. A whole range of things. Yeah, a really, really growing industry.
Have you had to do any special training with Jazz to get her to do what she needs to do?
We've had dogs for a long time. Jazz is the best dog we've ever had. We train all our dogs not to chase wildlife. That's the bottom line. That's the rule on our place. But she's just gone that step beyond and become such an integral part of a conservation property.
Is it that particular species of dog that is highly regarded for being a conservation dog, or are there other breeds of dog that could do this work too?
There is a number of other dogs. Springer Spaniels are commonly used as well. Border Collies are used. We're really focused on the Hungarian Vishla. We had a story told to us. We used to have German Shorthair Pointers, and the difference between a GSP and a Vishla is that the GSP will run straight through a barbed wire fence when it's on a scent. The Vishla will stop and wait for you. So it's a bit more of a thinking dog, and yeah, she's been great. So I think it's a fantastic breed.
You've got electric fences around your property. There's more going in. How's Jazz going to cope with them and making sure that she doesn't get zapped?
Jazz brushed up against the fence once in 2016. And she's never been near it since. So she won't even go through the fence when it's turned off. We actually have to carry her through the fence.
What other things has Jazz found on the property that you may not have come across if you were just looking with your own eyes?
So we're always conscious of recording the wildlife that's on our property. So we like to keep a record of how many echidnas there are. So I can find an echidna digging on the property and set Jazz out to find the animal so that I can actually sight the live animal rather than just the digging. So she's good at that. She'll also find fox dens for us. She's got a really big thing about stumpy tail lizards. She likes to find those and tell us when they're around, but you know, they're very common here, so that's just her thing, I think.
And some people would reward their dogs with food. Is that the kind of thing that you have to do, or is she just happy to go about her thing?
Jazz works for hugs. She's just loves people and she loves us. So normally you would reward a dog with food, and that's certainly how we started off with Jazz, but we've just subbed it out for cuddles and pats.
Oh, what a dog. Collignon's Fiona Murdoch speaking about her conservation dog, Jazz. And speaking about conservation, the Menindee Lake system is full for the first time in a decade. And as a result, the fish are breeding. Murray cod And golden perch supposedly going berserk. And for locals, it's almost miraculous to see, given the region was the site of the fish kill event 2 summers ago, where millions of fish died there. But lockdown means that people haven't been able to see the turnaround for themselves. But keen fisherman Robert Bosch, who is the president of the West Darling Fish Club, is over the moon and can't wait to get out on the lakes.
These fish now, that, and we've seen it about a year ago when we were doing a bit of yabbying in Pomamaru, Box Hollow, Kopi Hollow, when the water was still held back. We started to get signs then, and I thought, gee, this system might just bounce back a bit, you know. And we were getting yellowbelly that were about 60, 70, up to 100, 110 mil long, 120 mil long in the traps, you know, the yabby traps. And I remember saying to Pauline, you know, this might just come back, this is, it's the way it was. And, of course, the moment they opened up the lookout, the inlet into Lake Menindee, all those young fingerlings have now been flushed out of there and into Menindee Lake and Corndilla and what have you. And, you know, if we take the time out really to look after this system, slowly release this water down Little Menindee Creek and down the Anna Branch, all these fingerlings are going to end up down there, and of course they'll breed up, and they'll get to that breeding stage, and we'll have, you know, a good influx of yellowbelly, and like you said, the cod now are starting to breed. Once, well, this bit of a flush that's going down the river at the moment, they're letting about 1,300 mega water down out of Wetherill now through the weir pool. And that's only got to do with the world of good, mate, you know.
With the lakes and the river system right at the moment, though, Boshy, with no one technically allowed to be up there dropping lines in and fishing, and there's this 8-week period, you know, spring going into middle spring, I mean, that must just be the cream on the cake, a bit of a bonus?
Oh, of course it is, mate. It's going to allow those fish to multiply, and we've got good stocks of them, and then they'll breed, and we'll end up with better stocks. And one of my biggest pushes in the river for being for the last 10 or 15 years that I've argued with New South Wales Water and New South Wales Fisheries, the main weir, the block dam, the inlet into Pomamaru, we need a fish ladder there. That is paramount to these fish being able to migrate up the river from Wentworth through to Bourke. And if we can do that, get that migration going, then, okay, our system will come back to where it used to be a few years ago.
So, Boshy, now the $69 question is that when people are allowed to head back up to the Darling River and Menindee Lakes and drop a line in or have a crack at catching some yabbies, where would you go, Boshy?
In that weir pool, because that's where the fish have stopped now, mate. The fish have all come up from the lower part of the Darling up through the fish ladder at Weir 32. And a while ago, when it was running at about 5,000 meg, those fish would come up over Weir 32. And I'd say in the weir pool, there'd have to be some good fish in there now, right now. And with this flush that's coming down at the moment, it would be pushing a lot of fish through the blowhole and into the weir pool, and we get a flush of fish, young fingerlings, in the actual lower part of the Darling.
All right, we're writing that down. You know what's going to happen when the gates are open? There'll be 1,000 people up there in that weir pool.
Well, I hope what you say is right, that people are staying away from it because of this COVID thing. And I'd say that a lot of the people in Broken Hill would be, but people in Menindee, I don't know. They can go down to the riverbank and fish off the riverbank at Menindee.
Oh, it's essential. It's exercise.
Yeah, that's right, mate. You've got to exercise that right arm.
That's right.
And we can keep that water flowing in that river. Just keep that connectivity, you know, in the river. Then these fish are going to survive. And with 1,200 meg coming out of the blowhole right now, it's a wonder there isn't a heap of people sitting at Burke and Will's campsite lemon fishing.
I don't think so. I think they're all doing the right thing, Boshy.
Well, I hope so, mate.
Yeah.
And it's good to see it
bounce them back on its own, you know.
That was Robert Bosch, the president of the West Darling Fish Club, speaking to Andrew Schmidt. And when people can get out and about, I'm sure it will be a hive of activity there. That's it from me. But Sonia Veldhoff, what's coming up?
Hello, hello. Now, we know that when bushfires hit in South Australia, the community jumps in and helps. Now there is a registered and organised way that those with farm fire units can do that. So we're going to be looking at that today, along with those who are working very hard to prepare for the season this year in terms of our vets and those that are first on the fire ground for our animals. Plus, when it comes to rat poisons, would you be prepared to give them up to protect birds? That's what you're being asked to do. We'll see what you think about that and whether there are alternatives.
Hmm. Well, they do a bit of damage, but they're also very necessary as well. So I
guess it's like, do you want rats and mice running around in your backyard?
No. And then you've got the farmer situation with that too, which is exactly a whole other kettle of fish. So keep listening to your ABC.
Fish, birds, rats, we're doing everything today.
It's coming up to 1 o'clock, that time for news.